May it please the Court, Assistant Federal Defender Daniel Broderick on behalf of Mr. Turner. Your Honor, under the AEDPA, this Court looks to the last reasoned state court opinion to determine whether there was an unreasonable application of either fact or law. And with respect to the jury instruction issue in Mr. Turner's case, we look to the last reasoned state court opinion. It was not only unreasonable, it was dead wrong. It was completely wrong. His jury instruction challenge to the preponderance-laden predisposition instruction was rejected, and it's actually in the excerpts on page 44. They found that that instruction did not lessen the prosecution's burden of proof because the jury instruction, quote, closely resembled the instruction approved in People v. Fitch. In fact, it didn't at all. There is no mention in the jury instruction in People v. Fitch of the words preponderance of evidence. It's not there at all. There is no mention.
That it was wrong just to use the words preponderance of evidence?
Your Honor, I think in the context, yes, I think in the context of this case,
it is. You can't use preponderance of evidence.
Well, the current instruction that's in use in California, and this case obviously predates that, so the instruction used in Mr. Turner's case is not the one that's used now. The current instruction actually says, as we put in our reply brief, has something that's a little closer. It actually directly links preponderance to reasonable doubt. And what it says is, if you find by a preponderance of the evidence that the defendant committed a prior sexual offense, that is not sufficient by itself to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he committed the charged offense. That's the instruction in use now in California. So if you can explain to the jury adequately that preponderance for the prosecution.
Right. For use by the prosecution. I mean, it's pretty clear that it's the prosecution.
Right. Preponderance is used all the time, Your Honor, for affirmative defenses, entrapment,
right.
Arrest.
But here, I mean, there's no doubt that what they were talking about was that the prosecution had the burden by preponderance of evidence to present some evidence to show that Mr. Turner was connected with the prior offense.
Right. More than that. It went even beyond that, Your Honor. What it said was
a little long.
Well, it's not only a little long, it mentioned
a little repetitive.
Well, and hence it said it eight times, but it also said it in different contexts. What Your Honor is talking about is the first context. The first context was that you have to find by a preponderance of the evidence that he committed the prior offense. Okay. Then the next step is the one when they start getting in trouble, because the next one they start saying, if you find that he committed the offense, then that can be used by a preponderance in the evidence in determining whether the prosecution has shown he has a character trait to commit this offense. So it's that's the problem, is they say the prosecution can prove his character trait of committing these sex acts is sufficient, and you can use it, and they say give it whatever weight you want as a jury, that's what they were instructed, is sufficient to show specific intent to commit this crime. That's the problem. That they can, or the prosecution can meet, under this instruction, the prosecution can meet its burden of proving the element of the charged offenses with a preponderance of the evidence. We're also concerned that the timing, which also was different both in Fitch and in this Court's opinion in LeMay, the timing also completely wipes out the presumption of innocence. Unlike LeMay, we don't know when the instruction was given in Fitch, it doesn't say. Unlike LeMay, where this Court specifically says that it was given prior to this evidence being given, in this case, the preponderance instruction was given after the witness testified as to the prior act, before the defense case. So you're starting the whole defense case with a jury being told that you have to evaluate this evidence to see if the defendant can produce more evidence than the prosecution. And that's just not the way we try cases in this country.
Did it come at the end of the presentation? I think there were several witnesses.
There were a couple of police officers afterwards.
That testified about this prior incident.
Right.
It wasn't just the prior victim.
It wasn't just the victim. There was a police officer that said he denied it when he was questioned about it. So there was more evidence about
it. And then it was at that point that they gave the instruction, wasn't it?
Well, I think they gave the instruction. Well, Your Honor may be correct. I may just have misread where it is.
That's what I kind of
Yeah, I think they gave it. I thought they gave it after, I can't think of her name, the prior girl's testimony. But it could have been after the police officers. That I'm not positive, Your Honor.
Let me ask you this.
Yeah.
So what clearly established law did this jury instruction violate by the United States Supreme Court? I should say clearly established law by the United States Supreme Court.
Well, I think that on this one, the clearly established Supreme Court law is Sandstrom versus Montana, Patterson versus New York, in which the Supreme Court says the due process clause of the 14th Amendment requires the prosecution to prove every element of a criminal offense beyond a reasonable doubt. So that's the clearly established Supreme Court law that this violated.
Now, even if we were to agree with you, don't we have to get to Brecht on this issue?
Well, I don't think so. First of all, I think it's more structural than it is harmless, because this you really can't divine from this what the jury did. We have no way of knowing how this affected the jury, and this really goes to the actual what I would say is the core. It's far more a structural defect than a harmless error defect in this case, because you can't say what they did with this evidence. We're saying they didn't know what to do with this evidence. If Your Honor is inclined to go that way, in this particular case, what happened is the jury did give up three. It was not a slam dunk case, even with this evidence, even with this instruction. They had substantial testimony reread. They had three notes. It was not an overwhelming case for the government in this particular case. But I think it goes more to structural error. I don't really think it lends itself to harmless error.
Now, you know, you read the instructions in their entirety from the beginning to end. And, you know, the court does repeat several times that the government had the state, that is not the government, you know, the state of California had the burden to prove the defendant guilty beyond a reasonable doubt several times.
I think a couple
really
of times.
There really isn't any, you know, I came away with a feeling that the jury knew that the government had to prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt.
That's what I tried to make a point in my brief. I think there's a distinction here. And I read the same thing that Your Honor did. Read all the instructions, read the instructions and the supposed limiting instructions as well as the ending instructions. First of all, if we take both the limiting and the ending instruction, what we have, and I don't, numbers do matter some, we have 16 different mentions to this jury of preponderance in the evidence. I think we have three mentions of reasonable doubt. That's where the difference is. But assuming they could get through that and figure what it is, I think what the jury did, and this is what we tried to brief in the opening brief, what they were told is the government has the burden of proving the offense, the charged offense, beyond a reasonable doubt. Okay. The troubling thing I'm having here is I think the jury could very easily, in fact, that's really what it says, could very easily have said the prosecution only needs to prove specific intent by a preponderance. Because the judge has told you, the jury, that the character trait of intending to commit sex with an underage girl can be proved by preponderance of the evidence. And that's sufficient, and you, the jury, can give whatever weight you want for that. So I would tentatively agree with Your Honor that there are instructions in there, because there are, that say you have to prove the offenses, the prosecution has to prove the offense beyond a reasonable doubt. Although the context of that, I want to say the context of that's a little different. Where that came up really was after all this was read, then he says, now you've heard all this evidence about other act evidence, and the government doesn't have to prove, you don't have to find him guilty of the other act, you have to find him guilty of these acts. That's the context of where that came in. So it's slightly different than where it is. I think that if we look at LeMay, and I think LeMay is also a federal case, obviously, 414, I want to say something. The court accepted, and I disagree with the opinion, but the court accepts the federal statute only because it's filtered through 403, the balancing. Here, what we have to do, and that's to avoid unfair prejudice. Okay, what we have here are two problems in his case. One is the unfair prejudice. Independently, the jury instruction is unfair to him, and there's no examination of that unfair prejudice by the California courts. They don't filter that out in their calculus at all. They don't even look at the right prejudice.
What objections were made when that instruction was given?
Well, what happened, as far as I can tell, Your Honor, is the defense proposed an instruction and the prosecution proposed an instruction. The defense instruction was, and he objected to the prosecution's instruction. It was denied, or overruled, excuse me, and the judge gave, which is the only place I can imagine where I can see where this instruction came from. It seemed to come from the prosecution. So the judge gave the prosecution's instruction over defense objection and in lieu of the instruction submitted by the defense. So that's what happened in this trial. I want to just very, very briefly talk about...
And that was in Calgic?
This one, as far as I can tell, I can't see where this instruction came from. The one used in Mr. Turner's case, because it was not the one used in Fitch. So I don't know where the current one I read to Your Honor came from Calgic.
Yeah, but you can go to the library and see whether that was a Calgic instruction.
And I looked, and it wasn't this one. to my recollection, it was not this one, Your Honor, not anywhere near this one. So I don't know where the one used actually came from, except it was submitted by the prosecution in this
what,
one.
Was it typed up or was it printed?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor. I don't know from the record on that one. I just wanted to very briefly talk about, just make it clear what the last two sentencing issues are, so I'm not abandoning those, and the reason is because it could affect 100 years of a sentence. The last sentencing claim that I think makes the second to last one more clear. On the last sentencing claim, we said it was error to have sentenced him as a habitual sex offender and a habitual criminal. Now, the California Supreme Court has, in fact, said, subsequent to Mr. Turner's case, but has, in fact, said that the California legislature authorized that. That was in a case we cited in our brief. And so our argument on that issue is that that's arbitrary. The problem comes with 667.71, where he got three consecutive sentences for exactly the same thing, and there's not a whiff's worth of indication that the California legislature has ever authorized that. They can't cite an opinion, I can't find an opinion, nobody can find an opinion that says that has been authorized by the California Supreme Court, by the California legislature.
You mean consecutive sentences?
Three convictions for 667.71. It's only charged as an information one time. It's not charged on each one of the counts. It's one sentence in the information that says he's a habitual sex offender. And if you look to that statute, it says to be a habitual sex offender, you have to have a prior plus one conviction in this case, then 25 to life. So he got that. One time he got it. But what the judge did is he gave him 25 to life, doubled it on count two, consecutive to count three, consecutive to count three, so that's 150 years. So he got 150 years for something that the California legislature, my seeing of it, I see not an indication at all that it's anything more than a one-time deal. You can only be convicted.
The California Supreme Court ultimately said it was okay.
Not. They didn't, Your Honor. They absolutely did not under 667.71. They did not. They said in a different context as to you can sentence somebody as a habitual sex offender and habitual criminal. That's okay. They have never said you can sentence somebody three times as a habitual sex offender.
What's the clearly established law that would preclude that? What's the clearly established law by the United States Supreme Court?
Just have to turn for a second here. Oh, actually, I'm going to get the state wrong. It's something versus Hudson. I want to say Missouri. Okay, Missouri versus Hudson. In Missouri versus Hudson, what Chief Justice Rehnquist said in his opinion is that essentially you can avoid the double punishment issue as long as it is specifically authorized by the legislature.
Paul O'Connor for respondent. I have a number of points to make in response to Mr. Broderick's remarks. First of all, regarding the other crimes jury instruction, the trial court expressly instructed the jury that they could reach a guilty verdict only if they were convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that Petitioner committed the offense charged in the present case. So that was an extremely clear instruction that was given to the jury. That was given at Reporter's Transcript, page 473, lines 13 to 18. It's referred to repeatedly in my brief. Sterling v. Roe, a case I cited in my brief, says that we can look at other instructions and the party's arguments to show that a propensity instruction does not violate due process. And the same is true in this case. We can look at the other instructions that were given. For example, that the jury was instructed that the prosecution must prove each element beyond a reasonable doubt. They were instructed that if there's a reasonable interpretation of the facts which points to innocence, then the defendant has to be acquitted. They were instructed that the defendant is presumed to be innocent, and that means that people have to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. They were instructed that if there's a reasonable doubt, the defendant has to be acquitted. They were instructed that there has to be a union of act and intent, which clearly means that the prosecution had to show something more than there was a prior offense, and they had to show something more than the defendant was simply predisposed to commit these crimes. There had to be a union of an act, meaning the current offense, and an intent, meaning a mental state that coincides with the current offense. In light of all these instructions, it's unlikely that the propensity instruction would have been interpreted by the jury to allow a verdict based only on the prior acts and the predisposition to commit sex offenses. We can look at the parties' arguments in helping to determine how the jury would have understood their instructions. The prosecution, during his first argument, discussed the evidence relating to the current offense. The evidence corroborating the victim's testimony, the victim of the current offense. The defense attorney emphasized that the prosecution had the burden of proving the offense beyond a reasonable doubt. He emphasized that a couple of times very strongly at the end of his argument. Importantly, the prosecutor, in his rebuttal argument, acknowledged that the defense attorney's description of his burden was correct. He did not dispute that description of his burden. So that's an important point. Sterling indicates that if the majority of the evidence concerns the current offense, that would also suggest that the jury understood that it was supposed to find the defendant guilty or not guilty of the current offense, guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. Likewise, in the present case, the bulk of the evidence concerned the current offense, not the prior offense. I submitted a number of supplemental authorities about a week ago. One of them was a case called Smith v. Plyler, and that concerned a pre-1999 propensity instruction, just as we had a pre-1999 instruction in the present case. Smith denied habeas relief, noting that other instructions and the party's arguments emphasized the beyond reasonable doubt standard. Smith cited Regalado, a California appellate court case, favorably, which is a case that we've relied on in our brief. We cited Regalado for the proposition that the jurors would have understood that the disposition evidence is to be assessed along with all the other evidence to determine if the elements have been proved beyond a reasonable doubt. Smith said that the state court's denial of relief was reasonable based on a common-sense understanding of the instructions in light of the events that transpired at trial. In other words, the totality of the instructions, the parties' arguments, and the evidence that was presented in the case, again, you know, the bulk of which concerns the current offense, not the prior offense. Now, another point I wanted to mention was the controlling U.S. Supreme Court precedent, you know, whether the state court's disposition, the state court's denial of relief in this case, is contrary to or an unreasonable application of U.S. Supreme Court precedent. Well, the bottom line here is that the U.S. Supreme Court has not decided if a state law would violate due process if it permitted prior crimes evidence to show propensity. And Estelle v. McGuire, a 1991 U.S. Supreme Court case, left this issue open. The Ninth Circuit in the Garceau case in 2001 noted this, that the Supreme Court had left this issue open. And again, the supplemental authorities that I cited last week again, indicate that this is still an open issue. There's still no direct Supreme Court authority on this point, so there's no way that the state court's denial of relief could be contrary to any U.S. Supreme Court precedent. With regard to the LeMay case, of course, that case says that Federal Rule of Evidence 414 does not facially violate due process. California Evidence Code Section 1108 is modeled after Federal Rules of Evidence 413 through 415. LeMay says that Federal Rule of Evidence 403, which is discretionary exclusion of evidence, safeguards the right to a fair trial, ensures that devastating evidence with little probative value won't go to the jury. Likewise, California Evidence Code Section 352 is similar to Federal Rule of Evidence 403. It's also a discretionary exclusion of evidence where that probative value is...
You have all this in your brief, haven't you?
Well, a lot of it, yeah. And there's also some material in my supplemental authorities.
Would you just address counsel's argument on the very last point that he was making on
the sentencing things? I have a couple of points on the sentencing issue.
Very last point.
Okay. Was that Missouri v. Hunter, or was that...
The issue he raises.
Okay. Well, first of all, one thing I should definitely point out is that actually...
He says the California legislature has never authorized.
Right. That is actually...
Three consecutive sentences.
Right. That's actually incorrect. According to Murphy, the California Supreme Court case that I cite in my brief, according to Murphy, Section 667.71 authorizes separate consecutive sentences for each new conviction. Murphy says this at 25 Cal 4th at page 151. It says the defendant is being punished for new criminal conduct, which is one or more specific felony convictions. There's nothing in Section 667.71 that precludes additional consecutive terms when the additional terms arise from separate independent counts based on current substantive crimes. So, in other words, Section 667.71 authorized the consecutive sentences that were imposed in this case. And that is an opinion of the California Supreme Court, which, of course, is the final arbiter of state law.
Well, when the jury came back with his verdict, how'd that read?
I guess I would have to get the reporter's transcript, but I mean, I assume that there would be a verdict as to each count.
Counsel represented that in the information, the statement about habitual offender was not contained in each count of the information.
Well, yeah. I mean, the thing is, this is an important point to make too, and Murphy makes this point, is that Section 667.1, the habitual sex offenders law, is a recidivist punishment statute. Murphy makes that point again at page 151, and that belies petitioner's claim that 667.71 is an offense. It's not an offense. It's a recidivist punishment statute. It's a sentencing scheme. So the fact that they allege it only once in the information, really, you know, it's not important. I mean, it's a sentencing scheme, not an offense. So, and Murphy makes that clear. And again, Murphy is a California Supreme Court decision, so that's a final, you know, binding interpretation of state law. And then finally, the point I wanted to make on Missouri v. Hunter, I mean, given the fact that consecutive sentences are authorized by state law, Missouri v. Hunter actually helps us because it says, as the federal defender pointed out, that where the legislature specifically authorizes cumulative punishment under two statutes, it doesn't matter if these two statutes prescribe the quote-unquote same conduct. Cumulative punishment is acceptable. And again, because Section 667.71 has authorized consecutive sentencing, consecutive terms, and again, that's the opinion of the California Supreme Court in Murphy at page 151, Missouri v. Hunter supports us. So that takes care of those two issues.
We understand your argument.
Okay. Okay. All right.
Sure.
I agree. If Murphy says what he says it says, then on that issue I lose. I don't think it says what he says it says. And Murphy, I think, says what I said it says. But he's right. If it says what he said it says, that it's authorized, then Missouri says, okay, I don't think it says that. But what I wanted to address was, because this goes to LeMay and the Supreme Court precedent, which was our second issue, and what he said about no controlling Supreme Court case. That's a catch-22 that this court didn't deal with in LeMay that I think was a mistake. What this court did is they said we're going to look at historic precedent to determine what is fundamentally fair, and the court carved out an exception for what they called lustful disposition. It's exactly the same language, exactly the same citations used in People v. Fitch. But lustful disposition, when you look at those lustful disposition cases, they all refer to sex between the same two people. They all do. They're all about sex between the prior acts between the same two people. And if you even read them in the Michigan case that's cited in LeMay and cited in Fitch, and you go back, they even say it's there to prove opportunity. Opportunity. What that's important is because what that meant is all those cases that are cited all predated state evidence codes. They predated the federal evidence codes. So because they predated the federal evidence code, what happens is when the states 100 years ago started getting evidence codes, and the federal government came with an evidence code, they took all those cases and made them what we now have as 404B, other act evidence, opportunity, intent, between the same two people in the same act. The reason there is no Supreme Court case, and I agree, that's a problem, is because it never could come up. It couldn't come up because it was so accepted across the United States in every jurisdiction that you couldn't use predisposition to prove conduct in conformity in two separate offenses. But the only cases they came up were cases that were like 404B cases, either in the state context or the federal context, that people were attacking those cases as showing those were fundamentally unfair. The court would say, no, 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 but we're not going to reach the other one because it could never get to them. So that may be a catch-22 that I can't get over with the AEDPA, but that's the problem. The fact that the court says we have never held that doesn't mean it's not fundamental, as I just want to make that clear.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. The matter stands submitted. Should we talk? We're going to, Kathleen, we'll talk to your students. Where are they? Are they awake?
We're waiting.
Judge Pickerson, this is Professor Riley from USF, who organizes the international program and helped me bring them all here today.
Hi, Professor Riley.
Thank
nice
you so
to meet
much
you.
For taking some time with us.
We have about 16 students here from all over the world in a 9-month LLM program.
Oh, they're here for 9 months?
Yes, they're just beginning.
Okay. So this is the University of San Francisco Law School, international students. And they've had a tour of the courthouse.
Yeah.
And
you guys have lunch next door.
Yeah, we're
I know. That's
we do know you're all on here too, but we want
I see we have them here from Ethiopia, US. I don't know how that person got in here. Czech Republic, Taiwan, Spain, Czech Republic, Rwanda, France, French Polynesia, Mexico, Brazil, Mali, Philippines, Brazil, Uzbekistan, Netherlands, and China. Okay, quite a group.
We've got a few questions for us.
Who has some questions?
Maybe they do.
All right, so you just smile.
Gave them the briefs in advance on the medical marijuana cases.
Yeah.
I'll ask you. I'm Susan Mendelson, and I'm an adjunct professor at USF and work with the LLM students. Judge Pragerson, given your years of experience on the court, how has the practice of law changed?
Well, maybe you ought to ask, how have I changed? Well, I haven't practiced law since 1965, so, but just looking back at that time, things were certainly simpler. The cases were not as complicated. You know, Miranda was decided in 1965, and when I got on the federal court in 1967, and that's where you really learn about the practice of law. It was about that time that class actions came to the fore, draft cases came to the fore, ERISA came to the fore, and Title VII came to the fore, and there were always new legislation, new developments, many environmental cases, and now we're getting a batch of these marijuana cases. And you know, I never forget the words of Charles Dickens in Bleak House, which would be a good book for everyone to read, in which he says that the overriding principle of the English law is to always keep itself in business. And that's what happens. The new cases come on, and you know, you're supposed to laugh when I say that. And it's true if you stop to think about it. We move from one area of the law to another, new legislation. You got lawyers now that do nothing but read insurance policies for a living.
And offer opinions.
So it keeps expanding. I know when I graduated from Berkeley in 1950, there were just 70 students in my class, and the entire law school had, I don't know, maybe 200. And now you look at the classes that come out of law school, you know, by the hundreds, sometimes a thousand. And, of course, when I was in law school at Berkeley, there were very, very, very few minority students there. We had one African-American student. We had one Asian student. And we had three women in our class. Now you have more women in many law schools than you have men. And I think that's a good thing. I think in many ways I don't want to upset the men who are here, but in many ways the women are better advocates than the men. I mean, that's just the reaction I've had. We didn't have any women here today. But, did we?
Yeah, the first. Mr. Hassel's case.
Yeah. Mr. Hassel's case? That's so long ago I can't remember. to me, I mean, this is just my reaction. I like to see some of the women that have come before panels that I've been on. They just stand there like they're my English teacher, and they just look at you, and they're just telling you the way it is. They don't look at a bunch of papers and start reading, and they go right to the heart of the matter. So there've been changes, and I think it's good. And I like to see a lot of diversity in the law schools, and I like to see a lot of diversity in the bench. And so that's another big change too. I mean, we could spend a lot of time on that. And in L.A., when I got out of law school, the L.A. County Bar didn't admit blacks to the bar until the 60s. And women didn't serve on federal grand juries. And so there's been a lot of changes and a lot of progress, and I think it's a good thing. So stay with it. And what are you going to do with all this learning? Are you going to all go back to your countries? And what are you going to do when you get there? Start revolutions or...
Almost everyone here, well, everyone here has graduated from law school.
So to go back, sometimes they turn into judges. We have quite a few recently that have become law professors.
Well, they're bringing the what we call the rule of law. So, but you have to remember this. We had a president, first president of Mexico. His name was Benito Juarez. And you know what he said? He said, "For my friends, justice. All others, the law." So try to remember that justice is the most important ingredient of them all. Anyway, you know, Kathleen?
Can we just ask you about when I told the students how you're visiting us from the 8th Circuit, and you sat with other circuits as well, and how are you liking it here with us?
Well, I have sat with other circuits, and I like it every place I go. Everybody is very courteous and helpful, and perhaps they might be interested in understanding that in the federal system, so long as you're on active status, which my colleagues this morning are, the rules, with minor exceptions, do not permit you to sit outside your own jurisdiction. But when you get old, like I am, and become a senior, then you're permitted to go other places if you're invited to come. And I thank Judge Schroeder in the Ninth Circuit for inviting me to come. We don't have a lot of medical marijuana cases out in Nebraska because we don't have a comparable statute. But it's fun, and I'm happy to be here.
Thank you for coming. We need you.
But I think in places like Nebraska and Kansas, it just grows out in the fields, doesn't it?
I am an expert on hemp. Because it grows along every fence line and so forth. And a friend of mine who was in the Nebraska legislature for about 50 years said, "I don't know what all the fuss is about. I used to smoke hemp behind the barn when I was in grade school." So I don't know if that.
Yeah, well, you know, when I was in high school here, back in junior high school, you know, 38 into the 40s. I don't think that that marijuana was illegal, and but I don't know anybody that ever smoked it. See, as soon as you make it forbidden, then everybody wants it. So, but that's what I remember. We used to, in Spanish classes, we'd sing. You know, La Cucaracha, Marijuana Que Fumar, you know, and that was it, you know. And people didn't even smoke then. Now, times have changed.
Yes, I would like to ask you, how do you feel about the problem of split and circle? What do you think are the main reasons and that is coming to a different
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, you know, the fact that judges at an earlier time had made rulings.
Or on the same.
Oh, yeah.
Circuit conflicts.
Circuit split. Well,
we think all the other circuits are wrong when they're in conflict with our agency.
Well, it's good to have, you know, conflicts. And,
yeah, sometimes I think the Supreme Court waits to see kind of what the various circuits are going to do with a particular issue. They like to see if there's going to be a different view before they'll take an issue.
Yeah, we don't all march to the same drummer, you know. I mean, it's they're pretty independent. At least some of us are.
First, the honors. And my question is that this morning we heard some few cases, and may I know what is the procedure of the court as to who will write the opinion?
Okay, well, after we adjourn, then normally we go, we have a room over here, we sit and talk about these cases. We don't talk about the cases before we come here, see? And so we talk about them, and you know, basically the oldest active judge is the senior, that's me. And I think I'm older than you are.
Not much.
And so, you know, I'm supposed to make the assignments, but and we work those things out among ourselves. So, you know, if someone wants to work on this or work on that, you know, we get along. Nothing rigid about it. And then we see our court. I think Kathleen has told you how many cases we process a year? 10,000, 12,000.
I think it was 12,000 we've got. Yeah. 9,000 already this year. And
hey, the Supreme Court has it easy. They have 45 cases. We'll do that many this week. And anyway, I guess that's it. And I want to thank the professors for coming here and Kathleen. I first met Kathleen when she was working in Boise, Idaho. And he said, and she was running that court over there. She knew every case and every lawyer and what was going on. And so she told me she'd like to come to San Francisco. Well, I knew she'd worked for a district judge, and then she'd worked for another one. And I said, well, Kathleen, it's time for you to go out in the world, isn't it? And find your way. And she said, no, no. She said, you don't understand, Judge. I'm a Ninth Circuit junkie, and I've got to come back and work here. And she's been here, and she's been a great asset to us.
Thank you, Judge.
So go back to your countries and tell people to be free and to think for themselves. And the most important thing that we have to do in this world today is liberate women. You know, more than half the people on this earth are women, and we need to be grateful for that. But in so many places, women are oppressed and treated as property, and it's terrible and it's frightening. And I just hope in you know, this century that all that's going to stop, and that the men will stay home and let the women work. So, okay.
Thank you.
Most of the day here, but are you going to break for lunch? I'm sorry. I'm going to have to apologize. Thank you so much. I actually do have one on Thursday. I'm doing an immigration case.